You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the psychology of dating with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Our toll-free number to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we start these relationships, and usually the first few dates, things are going to be going pretty well, you'd think. But at some point, there's going to be a disagreement. Every couple fights. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the importance of how we disagree or argue, resolve conflict.
That's one thing that the social science does have a contribution to make that's useful in terms of dating and relationship forming and relationship continuing. It has been shown and quite clear that the way a couple handle adversity or handle conflict, handle an argument, really is the strongest predictor of the relationship enduring and succeeding over time. So that's a critical thing for people to pay attention to, say, if it does happen, as you just mentioned, on, say, date number three, whatever, how they actually interact to resolve or discuss, how they discuss the conflict.
Right. It's very important to understand, pay attention to the kind of language that people use. And sometimes men are a bit more guilty of this than women, in the fact that they may use very demeaning and critical language, contemptuous kind of language, in describing pretty much an objective situation. This happened, this didn't happen. And the language that people use, if they're kind of mean-spirited in their language, that is on a real slippery slope. If you do it really too often, then you're really telegraphing a very, very strong negative message to the other person, and they're going to start to be a little bit less responsive to you. So any kind of contemptuous language really is an indication that you're arguing very poorly and the relationship is not going to last. And you can pretty much tell when it's over, when the discussion gets into an area of disgustedness, and people can express disgust to their facial expressions or their body language or the language that they use. But as soon as one partner becomes thoroughly disgusted with another's behavior, that's pretty much irretrievable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's some research on there about social science and social interactions, and even from the forensic literature, once disgust gets reached, you've got to make a real serious intervention to make sure no one gets hurt. Mm.
Right.
So let's say that you're someone that you get angry, you say things you don't mean, and there are people who do that, and I have a relative like that, saying, "You don't mean that." "Yes, I do." And then later it's like, "I didn't mean it. I was just really mad." So you know you're that you've got to work on some issues there. How do you deal with if you're a person who, blurts these things out, how do you
stop
yourself?
Well, you can blurt things out, but as long as it's not language that is really demeaning or getting
like
to the area.
Name-calling.
Yeah. Right. Well, even name-calling, if it's kind of good-natured. Some people, call each other names. They've been friends for years, and they call this, putz or something like that kind of stuff. So it really depends on the strength of the relationship to begin with and the kind of things that they say that they apologize for later. But once it gets into personal integrity, when those things start to emerge, you have to jump on that right away to explore what's going on with that. And that could be for a number of different reasons, but typically that is either going to be from the person's own insecurity, that they're so frightened by the disagreement and they're so frightened by the perception of loss of something important to them, which is going to be the relationship and the value that they had in that they will lash out at the person because of their fear.
Right.
And it's really difficult to tell fear and anxiety from aggression.
Mm-hmm.
But most people, when they're in the middle of an argument, they're really having an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
And unlike what people say, when you're drunk and you say things, that's really the truth. Well, that's not really the case. But when you're anxious and you're saying things, that's not really the truth either. You're just responding out of your own anxiety. Once you're having a panic attack, and partly anything a person says could be taken as face value in a panic attack.
Yeah. You can be very irrational and you know, but you just can't stop
exactly.
it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that gets into several things that social science has come up with statistically, again, that will predict a difficult, if not a failed, relationship. Certainly alcohol or drug abuse is much more prone to relationship failure. Mm-hmm. If one of the parties is emotionally, or both for that matter, emotionally volatile, mm-hmm. Which is what you're talking
right.
about. Also, if one of them or both of them have had a history of childhood abuse, mm-hmm. They have a much more difficult time because they don't have the models for give and take.
Well, I think
empathy.
We just modify that last one. If they haven't been in successful treatment for that,
yes.
Any of these things.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I had a friend years ago, and his parents, they must have been like Ozzy and Harriet. I mean, mm-hmm. I had met them a couple times, but he said that he had never seen them fight, never raised their voices. They were a very loving couple. I mean, hard to believe, mm-hmm. right? Maybe they just didn't do it in front of the mm-hmm. kids. But when he started going to other kids' houses, and he couldn't believe, you know, he was just horrified. Oh my gosh, what's happening? But
no, I think there's quite a lot of that where the parents really never ever raise their voice, and there are some people out there who are very mild,
yeah.
and you can tell they're angry, but they don't express
right.
their anger in a very angry kind of situation. I think that's probably more common than what we might believe, because mm-hmm. everything we see depicted in television, movies,
right.
and even books, it's all about this volatile, crazy, dysfunctional family. We think that's the norm. It's not really the norm.
I guess it makes good television, right?
It
draws
makes good
us draws
sure.
us in. All right, your daughter or son is dating someone you don't like.
Gulp.
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to be able, it depends if you're a guy or if you're the dad or the mom, but you both parents have the obligation or the duty to sit down and talk about their concerns with their daughter and to be as factual as possible. And it's very important to differentiate if you have a grievance
mm-hmm.
and you're complaining. That's one thing that's not going to go over very well. But if you have some factual concerns and you're alerting the person to the factual concerns, that's okay, and that'll go over a little bit better. And it really depends a lot on the relationship that you have with your child. You can't have a lousy relationship with a kid for 15 years and then say, listen, I know what I'm talking about. And then the kid, you might know what you're talking about, but it's the horse has already left the barn.
Right.
So it really depends on how you present the information, but every parent has a duty and obligation to point out things that may not be really great. And also, remember, you want to keep your kids safe.
Yeah.
Sure. And add one other thing. They have a duty, obligation, and an opportunity at that point, even though there's a lot of emotion that goes into it. That's why I said gulp when mm-hmm. you posed the question. There's a lot of emotion that goes into it. But it is really an opportunity for parental teaching and parental instruction mm-hmm. or discussion, at least. So you want to find ways of interacting and discussing, because the child is learning to develop their own sense of judgment about interpersonal relationships mm-hmm. How they judge peers and interact with peers is going to determine how they live.
Right. Yeah. All right. I've got an unusual way that opportunity okay. there. This show, The Bachelor, which in all honesty, I think is so degrading to women. They bring these, 20 women and this guy gets to pick one and, but I watched a couple of seasons with my daughter and I found it a really good opportunity to have conversations that weren't me sitting down lecturing her about the do's and don'ts of dating and how you should behave. And as we're watching this, we're talking about these people on TV.
Right.
So I found the conversation much easier for her to say what she was thinking by using this as an example.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, but, I don't think you can beat that.
But I have to say, I mean, you do find yourself going, oh, he should pick her. You know?
Yeah, well, I think that's okay as long as you're labeling your own interests and your emotions and your behavior. Most parents should sit down. That's ostensibly why we have these ratings on movies, PG and, PG-13, to be able to provide some counsel as you're going along and answer any questions that the kids have. That's a perfect opportunity to reference things to yourself. It's not you have to watch out for. It's I remember when I was in the situation mm-hmm. than my experience was. So
right.
it's a good opportunity. That's a very good opportunity.
Yeah. Actually, we do that a lot. Mom, what did you do? Yeah, same kind of questions.
Good.
All right. So you mentioned earlier, Mark, sometimes the couple themselves may be suited, but the families are not. So the opposite, your mom or dad are dating somebody that you don't like. But you're a grown child. So what do you think?
Well, everybody has to adjust. Mm-hmm. Has to adjust to the way things are and choices that they make and they want to make. Hopefully there's open communication, I think, is the only thing.
Well, I think it's really important. I'm going to go a little bit out on the limb and say, if you're dating for the first time and you have kids and it's the first time you've just been through a divorce or separation or widowhood, I really think it makes so much sense to check in with a therapist or a coach to get just get some idea of what's going on with you, because you have to understand yourself. And it's important to understand something that we call a transitional object. Chances are the first person that you go out with after any relationship, chances are it's just a transition between, you know, the last relationship and another good relationship. That's not always the case. Mm-hmm. And it's possible for a transitional object to become the permanent object. Yes, that's very true. But you have to consider that with all the emotions going on in you, that you may not be as good a parent as you ought to be to your kids when they're younger. And mm-hmm. your parenting for the children as they get to be different ages is different. So they're going to respond differently when you're dating people, depending on whether they're 5, 10, 13, 19 years old. And you have to take that in consideration. You can't always decide, well, the kid is not going to let me decide who I'm going to go out with. Sometimes you really have to make that call and you have to end the relationship because it's so destructive to the child or the children involved. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be the adult and say, this is not going to work.
Right. And in the situation I think you were referring to where the child is the one who's dating as a teenager.
That's a different situation.
Yeah, that's a typical situation. Yeah. And you don't like their choices, or they're getting married and you don't like the choices. There's quite a marriage and the ceremony is really fraught with a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As anybody who's going through it will tell you.
Yeah. We have a caller. A caller suggests Parents Without Partners as a resource. That's a good one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep, there's a strong organization on the Cape, and mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people and the work that I do tell me that that's been very helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can compare stories. I mean, you're all
absolutely.
Parents, so yeah, it's helpful. You want to talk about some other research. Was it Rochelle's research? There was something else in your list there that you wanted to mention?
Just about the... a couple things. There is racial data available from the online and the dating data that we do have. We're not really a post-racial society. That's what the dating shows. We tend to go after or try to get in and meet people of our similar or same race in a large degree. Whites tend to... initiate contact with whites, blacks with blacks. Blacks are less rigid than whites. They're willing to cross the line more often. But by and large, we stay within our own ethnic or at least racial data. And also couples tend to form within the same ethnic and like Martha Stewart, income brackets.
And I think it's probably important to mention that's really a very helpful heuristic to think about, too. Likes tend to attract likes, and that tends to make things easier in the short term.
Right.
There are so many barriers. And I'm talking just about America. In Europe, it's very different, especially in England, it's very different. They have very few racial barriers than we do here. But in America, it's very, very difficult to surmount all the social stigma that's still attached to any kind of difference. Mm-hmm. So just keep that in mind. That's one more thing you have to tackle or hurdle you have to overcome,
right.
Which doesn't mean you should necessarily ignore those differences, right. But you should be aware of them and realize that's mm-hmm. something else you got to deal with.
So whatever happened to that old saying, opposites attract?
It's true. Mm-hmm. Opposites do attract. And you have to remember, probably the most important thing to remember is that there are people that you love and the people that you marry. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the people that you love are not people that you can marry because they cannot be a successful marriage partner.
Mm, interesting.
That's very important. Not everyone you love can be a very successful marriage partner. Mm-hmm. We love our parents. We love our grandparents. I don't think you're going to go marry those folks. Mm-hmm. And you have people, for example, you may love them, but as Mark said before, they have an alcohol problem, they have a drug problem, they have a gambling problem. These people are not very successful marriage partners. If you're going to have children, it really could damage their lives three generations away.
Mm. Sure.
You know, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, so keep that in mind.
Yeah.
When you're dating someone, you're dating someone for the benefit of yourself, but also your family three and four generations down the road. And that's what you have to understand.
Now, that, of course, dating when you're older, I mean, for some folks, it's not a marriage potential here. It's a companionship. It's somebody to go to the movies with or somebody to, you know, go to parties or dinners or things like that. So it's sort of a different, different outcome in the end because you're not looking long term in that sense.
True, but still, even at an advanced age, you have to understand that if you pick the wrong person, that wrong person can make your life, no pun intended, living hell.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking, and Mark said before, well, you know, what's the worst that can go wrong? Plenty, and I mean plenty, can go wrong. So you really have to keep in mind a long-term view. So you're online today, you want to find someone that'll be a good partner. What's it going to be like 3, 6, 9, 12 months down the road, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road? You have to think about all those things and consider them, not be afraid of them. Mm-hmm. Just have to actively think about them and consider
Have your eyes open.
You have to do that,
And I think, like Kathy said earlier, I think that the safety thing is an important issue. Yeah. You know, meet for coffee. Meet, you know, don't have them to your house right away. Meet meet them somewhere else and share your private information at a later date.
That's right.
All right. Psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, as always, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.